friend, with whom the spotting was a bit of a passion killer, to say the least. It was embarrassing and inconvenient. When the specialist in London learned that I had arranged a private referral in Guernsey, he totally changed his tune. In his referral letter, he insisted that treatment was urgent and that a hysteroscopy should be performed immediately. It was as if it had been written by a different person. He had never said anything like that to me. He hadn't even given me a biopsy for nearly a year. Why this sudden change? Although it was all highly suspicious, I had little choice but to put faith in the system. What else could I do? The hysteroscopy took place on a Thursday afternoon, and I remember waking up to find lots of medics peering over me, looking concerned. I told myself that was probably normal after anaesthetic. The following day, Andrew flew over to visit me. I had the weekend to forget all about it. I was sure by Monday the results of the operation would reveal little more than minor changes that might at the most need another colposcopy. I had no reason to believe otherwise. It was a beautiful, crisp autumn evening as I waited in the arrivals hall for Andrew, an irrepressible grin on my face. I was sure he was the one for me. I was so looking forward to spending the weekend with him, walking on the cliffs, sailing on my dad's boat, going out and visiting friends. The flights and phone bills between Guernsey and London were costing us both a small fortune, but we didn't care. It was money well spent. One of my former boyfriends had initially been charismatic and charming. I had thought he was a keeper, but then he began going out every evening, and what started out as verbal threats gradually became physical. He was always very remorseful the next day, and he would promise to make it up. But things got worse. I hate confrontation, but I was not willing to let myself be abused. I argued back, which only exacerbated the situation. One evening, he told me never to leave, grabbed me around the throat, and what happened next I will describe as a window incident. Fortunately, I was unharmed, but shocked to the core. Never leave. I was done. I packed my bags the next day and ran back to the safety of my island home. I didn't think my ex would dare come and threaten me surrounded by my family. Andrew, his polar opposite, was exactly what I needed. He was calm and dependable, kind and thoughtful, not too bad-looking, and a top sailor to boot. It was an irresistible combination. He had already talked about the longer term and was making it clear he was keen. No arguments, no violence. Things were looking up. After settling back in Guernsey, I had found myself a great job in a private physiotherapy practice. It was a busy clinic, and I was earning good money. And Guernsey was beautiful. A 10-minute drive after work would take me to the marina, where I could leap into a boat and go out sailing for the evening. But where would my relationship with Andrew lead me? Would I have to give up my Guernsey paradise to live in London? If we had kids, would I have to bring them up in England? Or would he be prepared to live in Guernsey? I turned it over in my mind as I paced around arrivals. My hopes and dreams. The two of us, building a future together. And then, there he was, running to give me a big warm hug. "Hi, darling," he said as I took his hand and led him to the car. It was a short journey back to the rented house I shared with another girl. On the way, he tentatively asked about my operation the day before. "I really don't want to talk about it. Can we just forget about it and go out for supper? There's nothing I can do about the result, so let's not give it a moment's thought." But that was not to be. We pulled into the drive, and as I looked up at the house, I saw my flatmate, Carol Ann, hurtling down the steps to meet me. Before I had even stepped out of the car, she blurted out, "Jane, your GP has been looking for you. He was here half an hour ago." "What? At 7 o'clock in the evening on a Friday?" I looked at Andrew with horror. We both knew that this was not a good sign. "I have to phone him," I said, my voice trembling. I ran upstairs, shut my bedroom door and dialed. My doctor was insistent he had to come and see me. No, please, just tell me now, I begged. I know it's bad news, otherwise you wouldn't have driven over. I can't wait. I need to hear it. So, reluctantly, he told me. He had talked to the gynecologist who had just operated on me. I would need a hysterectomy. It was cancer. He said that they had already arranged an operation the following Tuesday at Hammersmith Hospital. The surgeon had called in a favour with one of his friends in London to get it done quickly. I wondered if they thought it must be quite aggressive to have progressed so fast without anyone noticing. Or had it been ignored? I was too overwhelmed by the diagnosis to ask. My head was spinning. I tried to compute his words, but it felt as if I was overhearing a conversation with someone else. This couldn't be happening. I put the phone down, stared at it for a minute, and then I began to sob uncontrollably. My world had imploded. I was 30. I had cancer. I hadn't had children, and now it seemed I never would. I must have stayed in my bedroom for over an hour. When I finally came downstairs, I managed to stammer the one word. Cancer. They had already worked that one out. My smeared makeup and puffy red eyes told the story. Andrew hugged me and suggested we get some fresh air. Wrapped in warm clothes, we drove to a coastal path and sat in the moonlight on a bench overlooking the cliffs and the sea. I was in shock. So was Andrew. This shiny, happy new relationship was suddenly not so shiny. We had been together for only 2 months. Would our fledgling relationship survive this unexpected challenge? I was deeply distressed by the diagnosis and what it meant to both of us. I was young. I would survive. I felt certain of it. Cervical cancer, if caught early, was perfectly curable, I had been told. Well, I could only hope it was still at that stage. But I would never carry my own children. Perhaps someone could carry them for me. I had heard of surrogacy arrangements. I would still have my ovaries. The subject of death only briefly occurred to me. I had so many other worries. How badly would the operation affect my sex life? Would I still be able to have my own biological children using my eggs? I didn't even want to discuss these things with Andrew. I was too terrified that he would now turn his back on the relationship. Already it felt like an invisible curtain had come down between us. This diagnosis was going to change everything. Andrew was saying very little. I was unable to guess his thoughts, too consumed with my own. He had not seen this coming. He had no experience of dealing with such a situation and felt completely out of his depth. If we had been sailing and the mast had come down or the rudder had fallen off, he would have been the first to know what to do. But dealing with a distraught 30-year-old about to lose her womb to cancer? While I was obsessing about my infertility, he was worrying about how serious it might be. It was comforting that he didn't want to lose me, but I wondered if a self-protective instinct was kicking in, keeping him from growing close to me. If he were shutting me out, my situation would be far worse. A depressing sense of isolation began to descend on me. Only hours into my diagnosis, I was realizing that cancer's effects extend far beyond physical illness. I tried reassuring him that I didn't feel as if I were dying, but I could see that he was not convinced. A diagnosis of cancer means different things to different people. Some take it far better than others. But this diagnosis had implications for both of us. It would ruin our sexual relationship, certainly in the short term, and I had no idea about the long term. The gynecologist at the South London Hospital had told me only a few weeks earlier that there was nothing to worry about. He had always reassured me that cervical cancer grew very slowly. I had been proactive, having a colposcopy and going for checkups. So surely I must have caught it early enough. I ignored the niggling doubt in the back of my mind that it might have been growing for years, and that perhaps he had failed to do his job properly all this time. As we sat there looking out to sea, I convinced myself everything would somehow work out, that I would eventually land on my feet, even if my plans had to be altered. I could save my ovaries, perhaps have them frozen, then perhaps find a surrogate to carry my child. I had to get through an enormous operation the following week, but I was young. I would cope with this. Death was not my immediate concern. It was having children that mattered to me. A happy home filled with kids' laughter was what I had always dreamt of. Somehow, no matter how difficult, I had to find a way to make that dream come true. The rest of the weekend passed in a different mood. We cancelled plans to meet friends, but still went sailing. Andrew and I made practical arrangements, but the passion in our relationship had vanished. In its place was fear and worry. My feelings ranged from disbelief and anger to intense sadness and beyond. It all seemed so unfair, just when I thought I had found my happily ever after. I knew I had to break the news to my parents. They'd be devastated, especially as they'd been concerned about the way I'd been treated at that South London hospital. I couldn't face telling them in person, so in the end I chose to do it over the phone. I could tell that Mum was very distressed, but she immediately offered to travel to London with me on the Monday to help me prepare for the operation on Tuesday. Our relationship had at times been difficult, as mother-daughter relationships can be, but I welcomed her support. I didn't want to refuse her company, even though I knew it would be extremely hard for her. Mum had been diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer a couple of years earlier, but she had kept her treatment to herself, telling us all it was just a spot of bother. We weren't very good at sharing our feelings, but I knew she would be deeply traumatized by my diagnosis and my loss of fertility. She was really hoping to become a granny and was disappointed that I had kept on calling off engagements, two to be precise. I never told her about the window incident. I had very basic knowledge about cancer, just what I'd been taught as a physiotherapy student, but it seemed obvious that the early decisions were crucial. Some doctors and surgeons were better than others, too. I had already learned this at great cost. I worried that my choice could determine whether or not I survived. I was being pushed into surgery without any time to think or to check my surgeon's background. If you are diagnosed with an aggressive and fast-growing cancer, it is important to be able to make educated decisions fast. But I was given no opportunity for spending time on research. Was it so aggressive that I couldn't wait a week? All the urgency made me wonder just how bad it could be. All I had was a basic computer but no internet access in 1994. It was impossible to explore ways of saving my ovaries or to prepare for the extensive surgery. When I arrived at the hospital on the following Monday, the surgeon seemed nice enough. I had a long list of questions for him, not least the subject of saving my ovaries. I was desperate that they should be spared. I wanted to know what would happen if the cancer was worse than everyone thought. He told me that if the cancer had progressed to any lymph nodes, I would need chemotherapy and radiotherapy. He didn't offer suggestions about saving my ovaries, but I knew that those treatments, especially radiotherapy to the pelvis, would put them at risk of shutting down. I asked if he could perhaps freeze one of the ovaries, if when he opened me up, he thought I might need further treatments. He looked at me and nodded sagely. Was that a yes? I assumed it was. He quickly moved on to the operation and the risks. The next day, I woke up groggily after the 7-hour operation. As soon as I saw the surgeon, I needed to find out exactly what he had done. "Did you freeze my ovaries?" was my first question. I was desperate for reassurance. It was a shock to learn that no, he hadn't. Perhaps he thought the cancer wasn't too bad. But when the histology results came back, they showed that the cancer had spread to a great many of my lymph nodes. As he told me this, I was shaking with a mixture of fear, fury, and disappointment. There was no question that chemotherapy and radiotherapy would follow, and these would switch off my ovary function forever. Why hadn't he frozen one of them as I requested? How could he have just brushed this request aside? As I lay there, I realized that all was not completely lost.